Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the role of third-party presidential candidates in a race that pundits and polls are indicating Hillary Clinton has a widening lead over Donald Trump. That could mean, since the strongest message Clinton has been running on is that Trump will be a disaster for the country and the world, that the urgency of voting for her will dissipate, and unenthusiastic voters on the left might then turn to Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. Henry Weinstein, co-director of the Center on Law, Equality and Race, with a joint appointment in Literary Journalism and Law at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times, "In the Nixon-Humphrey Election, I Refused to Vote for the Lesser of Two Evils. That was a mistake," and explain why voting for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson is a luxury that American democracy cannot afford. Then we'll look into the proposed AT&T-Time Warner merger in a $85.4 billion deal that has AT&T buying Time Warner, which appears to be good for the banks, corporations, and executives involved in the deal, but bad for the U.S. consumer. Victor Picard, a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania and author of America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform, joins us to discuss why consumers will end up paying more for this deal and getting less, and why the Justice Department Antitrust Division should block it. Then finally, we will speak with Justin Salahani, who is a writer and journalist based in Washington, D.C. and Beirut, who is a world reporter for Think Progress focusing on human rights. He has an article at Think Progress, Calais Refugee Camp to be Dismantled, and we will discuss the eviction of over 7,000 mostly African and Asian migrants stuck in a makeshift camp called the Jungle on the French coast at Calais, who are blocked from entering the UK, where some have relatives. With the French government moving the migrants to so-called welcome centres, we'll examine their likely future and fate. And joining us now is Henry Weinstein, who is the co-director of the Center on Law, Equality and Race, with a joint appointment in Literary Journalism and Law at the University of California, Irvine. He was a Los Angeles Times staff writer from 1978 to 2008, reporting on poverty, labor, politics, and law, and has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, "In the Nixon-Humphrey Election, I Refuse to Vote for the Lesser of Two Evils. That was a mistake." Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Weinstein.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to be with you.
And likewise, and thanks for joining us, Henry. And I was struck by your piece in the Los Angeles Times, because one of the things I find extraordinary is, in spite of Donald Trump's extraordinary antics and appalling statements and behavior and past, I could go on forever, nevertheless, he's pretty close to Hillary Clinton in the polls. And when you keep seeing the four candidates listed, you realize that the candidacy of Gary Johnson and Jill Stein combined is a bigger factor than the difference between the two candidates running. And that would indicate that these third-party candidates have an enormous amount of influence over this race, which may not be the blowout that people are predicting.
Well, the numbers certainly indicate what you're saying. It does vary from state to state, but I think I haven't seen any set of numbers that would indicate that they're not going to have an impact. Certainly in some places, it may not be the case in California, but it certainly could be in other places. I wrote this piece which involved this, I think, which could be candidly called a certain amount of self-criticism of what I did when I was an angry 24-year-old in 1968, and a number of us were very angry with Vice President Humphrey, who became the Democratic nominee. A number of us had admired him for a great number of years because of his pro-worker and pro-civil rights record, but he then became a shill for President Johnson in support of a war that we considered illegal and immoral. And those feelings intensified by when he became the nominee in 1968, even though he had not won one primary. As you know, Gene McCarthy won primaries, Robert Kennedy won a number of primaries, and he was assassinated. So when it came to the convention, basically what you had was you know, you had Humphrey, who was the candidate of the sort of the party leaders, party bosses, and there was McCarthy, and then of course, you know, McGovern got nominated but didn't really have anything organized, and so, you know, a number of us just decided that we were going to vote for a third party candidate, and we sort of ignored Richard Nixon's horrible record, and Nixon became the president, and with Kissinger extended the war for 7 years, put some terrible people on the Supreme Court. And so I and a number of my close friends from the era, we've talked about this periodically, and we said that we did understand, you know, we could sort of understand in retrospect what we had done, but we concluded that we were wrong, and that, you know, you have to be, you know, you've got to be practical. I mean, you know, it's not, you know, you're not voting for perfection, and there's just no way to say that Hillary Clinton is anything remotely like Donald Trump. I mean, she's, you know, I don't agree with all of her positions. I said that in the piece. But, I mean, she's just a million miles better than Donald Trump is today or has ever been. And a couple of other things to say. I just don't consider Jill Stein a credible candidate. And look at Gary Johnson, if you're a progressive. He is against every form of progressive social legislation, unless, of course, maybe it involves decriminalizing drugs. But he's against most social programs. So I don't see how anybody who could be a progressive could support Johnson. And I just think voting for Stein is throwing your vote away. I mean, a lot of other people, I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of emails from people of all ages responding to my piece, parents sending it to their kids sending it to their parents. And one of the things I'd also say is, like, the great climate change activist Bill McKibben says, yes, we should vote for Hillary and then fight like hell to make sure that we get progressive legislation and stuff like that afterward. You know, an election is not the beginning and the end of politics in this country.
Well, you certainly, in your piece, Nixon Humphrey election, I refuse to vote for the lesser of two evils. That was a mistake. Your choices were pretty chimeric, weren't they? Dick Gregory, you voted for. African-American comedian who was a civil rights activist. He opposed the war, and a lot of your friends at the time voted for the Black Panther Minister of Information, Eldridge Cleaver. As you point out, Cleaver got 27,707 votes, and Dick Gregory got 3,230, one of which was your vote. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was, like I said, it was sort of like, I mean, I knew I wasn't going to, you know, Gregory wasn't going to win. We knew that Cleaver wasn't going to win. Some people, McCarthy was still on the ballot. I think he got about the same number of votes as Cleaver, the you know, I guess you could call third or fourth party candidate that got a great number of votes in California that year, but not enough to tip the balance. Was George Wallace, who was on the American Independent Party, you know, virulent racist, but not enough votes to change the outcome in some way. We knew Gregory wasn't going to win, and people who vote for Jill Stein know that she's not going to win either. So the question is, and, you know, and some people will say, well, they should vote strategically because, you know, you can start to develop the Green Party in various places. I just don't see a lot of grassroots work that the Greens are doing in this country compared to what they've done in Europe. And in any case, I just certainly would not take any risk whatsoever that Trump could win. And it's not just a question of the question of whether he can win. As I tried to point out in my piece, it's a question of the margin and what the margin means. And the fact is that Trump has tapped into and stoked racism, sexism, virulent xenophobia. He wants to get rid of Roe versus Wade. He'd put people like Scalia on the Supreme Court. I mean, no one knows exactly what any individual person is going to be like as president, but he's made very clear a number of things that he would do, and I'm not in favor of any of them.
Again, I'm speaking with Henry Weinstein, who's a co-director of the Center on Law, Equality and Race, with a joint appointment in Literary Journalism and Law at the University of California, Irvine. He was a Los Angeles Times staff writer from 1978 to 2008, reporting on poverty, labor, politics and law, and has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times in the Nixon-Humphrey election, "I refuse to vote for the lesser of two evils. That was a mistake." And the margin, of course, that elected Nixon in 1968, he defeated Humphrey by 223,000 votes, which is nothing in a presidential race. So,
nationwide, the margin was 0.7 tenths of 1%. And one of the other things I said in the piece was it wasn't just a question of, you didn't necessarily vote for him. But I mean, if you want to win elections, you go out, you register voters, you talk to your neighbors, you work on the day of the election to get out the vote. I mean, during the 2008 election, I worked for Obama in the primary after I left the paper in North Carolina, and then a general election in Virginia. And one of the things that anybody knows is that, I mean, it's not just saying I'm for somebody. The question is, what do you actually do? Do you send a check? Do you knock on doors? There's all kinds of ways that you can help somebody get elected. And the fact that somebody gets elected doesn't mean that you embrace everything, that they do. I mean, I've probably voted for Jerry Brown for various office 6 times. Doesn't mean I favor everything he's done. I mean, I've lobbied for things that he was against or something. But, true for various presidents. But, I mean, it's just one part of the process. I mean, some people are treating this as if this was some sort of isolated moral act dissociated from other events. I just don't view it that way.
Well, you can't blame people for wanting more choice. We're supposed to be in a culture and a system that offers choice. It doesn't really. In the program today, we're also talking about the AT&T Time Warner merger, where there's going to be less and less choice as these major mergers take place in every sector of the economy. And we don't have a full spectrum of political choice, and we certainly don't have a full spectrum in the media as they do in Europe, where you have papers, that go from all the way from the Maoists on the left to the ultra-fascists on the right. So that's something you can't blame people for.
I certainly think that we should have more choice of candidates, and I also think that we should have more choice in the media. The idea of this the AT&T Time Warner merger sends chills down my spine. I can remember when a friend of mine was teaching a journalism class, and she told her students this some years ago that they might eventually be working for a telephone company, and they laughed at her. Well, it turns out that may turn out to be the case. I wish we had more choices. But part of the way but this country does not seem to be very amenable for a whole variety of reasons to third-party candidates. I mean, the system is structured against third-party candidates. I mean, there's probably a lot of ways that we could change our voting system that would make these elections more amenable to third-party candidates. But this is a very different country than it was, say 100 years ago when Eugene Debs got votes from a lot of ordinary Americans, even when he'd been jailed for opposing the First World War. He was a socialist that a lot of people identified with and had an organization that distributed a million copies of its newspaper every week out of a little town in Kansas. I mean, there's nothing quite like that. And I would go back to the point is that people need to recognize as a wonderful SDS organizer, Michael Ansara, said, and I quoted him in the piece, it wasn't so much that we were wrong about Humphrey with our criticism, but we just failed to recognize the difference between having sort of what he called a corporate centrist liberal versus a really horrible person who had no regard for the Constitution. And I will tell you, as of this moment, Donald Trump has manifested attitudes that are worse than the attitudes that Richard Nixon manifested.
Well, it does seem, though, that we do have that the fundamental difference that I see, Henry, is that we have a different system. We have a system where you form your coalitions before the elections, as opposed to after the elections in parliamentary systems.
And right.
So that doesn't lend itself to third parties necessarily.
Right.
But it does allow activist groups on the left and the right to essentially take over a party, which the Tea Party have almost done with the Republicans. And I've always been mystified why the progressives can't take over the Democratic Party, although under Bernie Sanders, he gave Hillary Clinton a good run for their money.
He certainly did. I think it's pretty clear that he has moved her on certain issues, on a variety of issues. And the other thing is that Bernie Sanders himself is now campaigning for Hillary Clinton, as is Elizabeth Warren, who's probably arguably the most progressive member of the Democratic Party, certainly on bread and butter issues, standing up for the ordinary American. And the fact is that Bernie says that anybody who thinks that they're going to support somebody else you know, is not has not understood what his message was. I mean, you know, this was a guy. I mean, he was a Democratic socialist. He also had, you know, before he became a senator, he was a congressman. He was a mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And if you study what Bernie Sanders did in Burlington, Vermont, he realized he wasn't going to be able to get everything he wanted, and he learned the art of practical politics. He may have been the most progressive person running this year, but he also understood, you know, things about reality. This is, you know, this is not a simple system.
Well, I think you can make the case, though, with the Green Party, and this radio station, KPFK, has had Jill Stein on around the clock, and almost everybody, if there was an editorial position with the Pacifica Radio Network, it would be to vote for Jill Stein. So I'm pretty much an outlier in the sense that I think she's a total fraud. I think the party itself is a fraud. They haven't done what you pointed out earlier that the European Green Parties have done, which is get people elected and build grassroots coalitions and basically build parties. All they do is parachute somebody in every 4 years, and it doesn't matter who they are, and they just get to go around and make speeches. They are entirely about rhetoric. And if you have a candidate, particularly one that I think is compromised, like Jill Stein, who went with crazy General Flynn to Moscow to hang out with Putin for the anniversary of RT, the Russian English language television propaganda outlet, who actually says constantly that there's no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, which is an appallingly stupid thing to say. I just, for the life of me, don't understand.
Well, it's a creation of a false consciousness. And when I was, mind you, I'm probably a little older than you are, but when I was a college student, we had an expression for that kind of behavior, and I didn't come up with this term. I think it might have even been Lenin, referred to this as infantile leftism. That's what I would call this. And I would just say one other thing. I mainly focus my piece on, you know, of 1968 now, because I wanted to take responsibility in public for what I did in 1968. I did not even mention the 2000 election, where anybody who can count knows that Al Gore barely lost Florida, I think it was 537 votes, and Ralph Nader got 90,000 votes in Florida, and he got votes in a lot of other places. And his position at the time was that Gore and Bush were Tweedledee and Tweedledum. The fact is that Al Gore would not have put John Roberts or Sam Alito on the Supreme Court. He also, I think it's highly unlikely that he would have taken us into war in Iraq. So anybody that says that Al Gore and George W. Bush had very little difference, that is a distortion of history and putting blinders on yourself in a way that is counterproductive.
So do you think, though, Henry Weinstein, that when people get into the booth, that they might change their mind, that a little bit of reality might, you know, as I said earlier, I'm astounded that Trump is polling remotely close to Hillary Clinton. Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager, says that there's going to be an upset surprise. They keep talking about these people that don't declare who they are, and that a whole bunch of surprise voters are going to come out of the woodwork. I don't know whether that's wishful thinking or not, but
I have no way to guess what is in the mind of somebody when they walk into polling booth, you know, other than myself or somebody who I've talked to in great depth about it. But I mean, she was a shill for Ted Cruz. Now she is a shill for Donald Trump. I give no credibility to anything that she says. I mean, I realize polling data is not always reliable, but the other thing that he's doing and that Trump is doing that people need to fasten in on is that Trump is making up all these phony statements about, you know, rigged elections, voter fraud, and so on. I mean, there's numerous academic studies that show that this is a falsehood, that there's no data to back this up. I mean, that the number of voter impersonation cases is minuscule in this system. And what he's basically doing is encouraging vigilantism, to have people go to the polls, you know, meaning white people that are supporting him, to try and intimidate people in inner city neighborhoods or neighborhoods where there are a lot of, you know, Latinos from voting. You know, people should be fighting against that. I mean, that is a disgraceful thing. This country, you know, as you know, for many, many years in the South, black people didn't get to vote. People like, you know, gave their lives in the campaign to have to allow black people to participate. We're now 52 years since the assassination of Andrew Goodman, Mickey Schwerner, and James Cheney in Mississippi, who went there to try and help people to vote, as there was their democratic right in the United States, and they were murdered by law enforcement agents affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan. And Trump is basically encouraging that kind of behavior now. I mean, people should vote against him for that reason alone.
Well, just in closing, though, the fact that Hillary Clinton has never really had a narrative, she's not run a good campaign, as she did also did not run a good campaign in 2008, and that does give you pause about the kind of people she's going to hire, given the people she's hired to run her campaigns. But and she's never really had a message. You've always known what Trump stood for. He's going to build a wall and make America great again. Finally, Hillary Clinton seemed to have gotten a narrative later in the campaign, which is, you better vote for me because Trump is a complete catastrophe, which is I think, a compelling fact. But now that the pundits and the pollsters are telling us that she's got a terrific lead on him, and they're even talking about certainly the Democrats picking up the Senate, if not the House, is that likely to play against her core message, which is you have to vote for me because this other guy is a disaster?
Well, certainly people that I know that are supporting Stein and some of the responses that I've gotten in my article have indicated that kind of sentiment, you know, that we're not enthused about her, we're afraid she's going to lead us into war, she's too close to Wall Street. From my point of view, she's too close to Wall Street. I think she's still much better, I mean, no comparison better to Trump. And the question is like I said, this is does not begin and end at on Election Day. The fact is that a number of us who supported Obama in 2008, we fell down on the job after he was elected. We should have pushed much harder immediately for, you know, reform on the economy and on the mortgage crisis. I mean, there was which I think would have helped nip some of the Tea Party stuff in the bud. But the fact is, like I said, this is not an isolated event. And as I said in my piece, I think it's very important not just to defeat Trump, but to defeat Trumpism, which stands for racism, xenophobia, anti-Roe versus Wade, unlimited weapons. I mean, you name it. You name almost any issue in which so-called progressive, the core subscribers of KPFK, of which I have been one for more than 40 years, things that they are against, that's what he is for. You want to defeat that in the ringing terms.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Henry Weinstein.
You are most welcome. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Henry Weinstein, who's the co-director of the Center on Law, Equality and Race, with a joint appointment in literary journalism and law at the University of California, Irvine. He was a Los Angeles Times staff writer from 1978 to 2008, reporting on poverty, labor, politics, and law, and has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times in the Nixon-Humphrey election, "I refuse to vote for the lesser of two evils. That was a mistake." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the proposed AT&T-Time Warner merger in an $85.4 billion deal.
You don't need to change. The future's odd. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Victor Picard, who's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, who has been a senior research fellow at Free Press and the New America Foundation. And with Robert McChesney, he co-edited Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? His latest book is America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and The Future of Media Reform. And he has an article at Origins, Media and Politics in the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victor Picard.
It's great to be back on the show, Ian.
Well, thank you, Victor. And the proposed merger, or I guess it's AT&T is buying Time Warner. of course, you can't help remembering that Time Warner sold itself some time back to AOL, which I think almost every business reporter on the planet recognizes as one of the most foolish deals ever made in corporate American history. So this is not so much foolish, from what I understand, as almost mendacious, because the people who are going to get hurt in that, this is a straightforward deal where the corporate people involved are all, you know, scratching each other's back and mutually benefiting from the deal. The banks on Wall Street are benefiting the deal, but the consumers are going to get hosed.
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment. I don't think, I think regardless of how you look at this, it's hard to see any way in which it would benefit consumers, although that's exactly what you'll be hearing a lot in the months ahead from industry representatives, that this will be a win-win and will lead to lower costs, but probably the exact opposite will be true.
So on the surface, though, isn't it logical that if you do this $85.4 billion merger, AT&T doesn't have that kind of cash. So the way these big mergers are done is that investment banks and groups of them basically do these bridge loans, don't they? And isn't that how it works?
And that, yeah, I think so. I certainly don't know all the details, what happens behind closed doors, but certainly they have to raise a lot of money and typically go into considerable debt to finance these mega mergers. And then, of course, those costs are put off in various ways to consumers. They have to usually raise prices. And not just consumers directly. Sometimes it comes in the form of charging other cable companies, for example, more money to have access to their programs, like their HBO programming, for example. And then in turn, those cable companies will then charge their customers more. So one way or the other, the customers are going to have to pay for this.
Well, that's the logic that I'm referring to, that, you know, then on top of that, you've got the fact that what was seemed to be happening in terms of the pipe into your home and the poverty of choice that you have in terms of the bundling that these cable companies do, that has been a hideous trap that Americans all across the country are stuck with. You don't have choice in terms of who your cable providers are, by and large. And you know, if you do, it's a choice between two identically predatory and expensive operations that charge you more for less and less. And that's just, we've been trapped in that system. But there have been some innovations like Netflix and Amazon that have started to change this terrible market for consumers in terms of information and entertainment. And now this is an example of rolling back the clock. To my mind, this AT&T Time Warner deal is a bundling deal. You know, I thought we were getting out of the woods, getting away from these bundlers who have you trapped and just milk you dry. Tell me what's your reaction to it?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one way of understanding it. Another way of basically saying the same thing is that this is what you get with this kind of vertical integration. This counts as a vertical merger where you have a massive telecommunications company, AT&T, which was already the largest PTV operator since it recently acquired DirecTV. It's the second largest wireless data provider in the U.S., and it's the third largest broadband provider. And then now it's going to merge with what's considered to be the fourth largest media company in the U.S. So you've got the same company that owns the conduits, the pipes through which the content flows, also owns the same content provider. So, yes, in many ways, it's a kind of bundling scheme where they're able to own both production and distribution.
So I think we've established that the consumer's going to get hosed, that this is a retrograde step away from some of the choice that these new innovators were bringing into this market. And we've also established that because so much monies have to be borrowed to finance this merger, a bunch of these corporate people who made these deals are going to get massive compensation. And at the end of the day, the debt that they've incurred to make this deal will be paid for by the consumer with extra charges. Where then do the regulators stand? What's the chances of this one being approved?
Well, that's the question that everyone's asking right now, of course. And there are a lot of regulatory experts who are saying that because it is a form of vertical, it is a vertical merger that these tend to go through, at least in recent history, that might be true. But I think, I would give it, at best, a lot of people are saying 50-50, and it's really going to be determined by what happens with the next president's appointments to the Justice Department, even though there will be plenty of congressional hearings and lots of people will weigh in on this. It's really going to be the Justice Department that decides whether it passes regulatory muster or not, and really look at the antitrust issues that come up with this. So that's, and it's going to take months before this gets decided.
Well, if Hillary Clinton's not elected, and we don't know what her position on antitrust is, as far as I can know, maybe you know something, Victor, but what we do know about Donald Trump is that just today he said that he was basically going to get rid of 80% of all regulations.
I didn't see that one in the news. But, there are all kinds of contradictions. But apparently he has come out against this merger. It's probably more of an opportunistic thing. And, of course, he, I believe, hates CNN. I think right now the fact that you have all these leading politicians coming out against the merger, you've got grassroots activists, you've got public interest groups coming out. I do sense that there's a political shift happening right now. I do think we're beginning to realize that we've allowed these oligopolies to take on too much power in all of our sectors, but especially in the media and telecommunications sector. So, I would be optimistic that political pressures will push this in the direction of not allowing the merger to go through.
So what, failing that, though, since the antitrust division of the Justice Department has somewhat been withering on the vine for the last few decades, certainly we don't have the energy of Teddy Roosevelt's trust busters anymore, but we do have some competitors like Google and Apple, for example, which have massive market capitalization. You know, AT&T's market capitalization dwarfs both Apple and Google. But at the same time, because they're so powerful, particularly Google, you wonder whether giving more power to them is actually a good idea. But at least they're laying down fiber optics, Google are, and I don't know how far along they are. But that's the problem, isn't it? That here we are in the country that invented the internet, and other countries like Japan and South Korea and even France have 1 gigabyte, 1,000 megabyte service that's universal, that's cheap, about a fifth to a quarter of what AT&T and Time Warner charge. And there's a couple of examples in this country in Chattanooga, I think. Google's starting to put them in a couple of cities. But in general, we're being held back, the country that invented the internet. The average internet speed in this country is 9 megabytes, which is just shameful. So is that something to look towards with wary optimism?
Well, what you just laid out there didn't sound overly optimistic to me, but I agree that we're seeing this kind of concentration in every area of our technology and media sectors, and the fact that we now have these platform monopolies that have incredible power, I think also deserves more regulatory scrutiny. It would be one thing if we acknowledge them as being what are considered to be natural monopolies, which means we concede that they are monopolies, but they're also heavily regulated. And right now we, in many ways, have the worst of both worlds by having these monopolies that are not regulated to any extent. So, I don't know. I think the very least we need to prevent these oligopolies from getting any bigger. I don't know if we'll see another bus trust or trust busting era. Some people would search for that, but at the very least, I think we need more scrutiny with these mergers.
So how do you, I've never talked to anybody that's happy with cable companies and the bundling and the choices that you get. And, you know, lately, just in terms of my own internet and cable access, DirecTV, Warner Cable was sold. And now it's called Spectrum, so there's a whole new company there. Mm-hmm. The other one was sold to a company called Frontier that nobody's ever heard of, and nobody's ever heard of Spectrum. And it looks like you keep getting bills from different people, and the bills go up, and there isn't any choice. I mean, there literally isn't any choice, and that. So I'm just wondering whether there is a consumer revolt going on. If you've got everybody in the country knowing that they're paying more for less, but they don't know about how much better off the rest of the world is, at least in terms of the advanced countries, what do you think can be done to start a consumer revolt? Because this, to me, smacks of the worst kind of arrogance, where a bunch of corporate titans get together, feather each other's nest, you know, fill each other's pockets up, and then pass the costs on to the consumers with worse service for more cost.
Yeah, so the question of what would actually create this needed revolt, I think we've seen signs of it in the past where people are able to connect their everyday realities and these pocketbook issues with the fact that they're living under monopolies. I mean, essentially, this is what it feels like to live under a monopoly. And, once they're able to connect the dots, we saw this around the net neutrality debate, where a really wonky technical issue galvanized millions of Americans. So I don't think it's beyond that. I think it is something within the realm of possibility, but we're at a very early stage where right now I think it's even just starting to happen where political elites are recognizing that this is a problem. Various social movement groups have been organizing around this for years, like Free Press, for example. Where I do have optimism is that I think people are starting to wake up. And you're absolutely right. People have no choice in terms of what their broadband service provider should be, how much they're paying for cable television on a monthly basis. So I think that people might start to wake up around these issues.
So is there, though, a movement? I mean, you would think that maybe the libertarians would be interested in this movement if they truly do believe in market capitalism and choice. It just seems to be that the purpose of capitalism nowadays and for the last few decades has become a drift towards monopolies. Whatever sector you're in, it seems that everybody's consolidating, where you only have two or three huge companies in every economic sector, every part of the economy, and it's clearly happening with information and entertainment. But isn't it happening across the board?
Yes, it is, absolutely. This is symptomatic of these larger structural problems. But the difference with the media and technology sector is that people are really grappling with this, experiencing this every day. And, of course, when we're talking about media and technology, when we're talking about the Internet, these aren't just widgets. You know, this isn't just the price of food or cars or clothes. These are things that our democracy depends on. So the stakes are considerably higher. And I do think that people will start to organize against this, but again, it's going to take us and people in the media to be able to help connect the dots so that people understand that it is because they're living under these monopolies, that their services are so bad, they're paying so much. So I think that can happen.
Well, just in closing, Victor Picard, is there when will we'll be able to at least weigh in on our political representatives? Do you know when there's going to be hearings, and at what point would it be a good time for all of our listeners who are, I think, are all righteously angry at their cable companies and the poverty of choice involved in that situation? When would the time be to weigh in?
Well, right now with this election is always a good time. I think a lot of people are sort of holding their breath, just waiting to see what happens with the elections. But I think you're going to see, I mean, going back to your earlier question, Elizabeth Warren made a really important speech to the New America Foundation a few months ago, where she was really declaring a new era of antitrust activism and really recognizing this monopoly problem that we're facing in all of our sectors, especially media and technology. So I think that we need to look for those openings, and there are potentials to, on this issue, to actually work with libertarians and conservative Republicans who are also losing patience with these monopolies.
So, in other words, you can Bernie Sanders, who's against this deal, could we work in? You could form a coalition with others. I don't know. The libertarians are a bit of a joke, aren't they? Gary Johnson doesn't. I'm sure he, if he can't name world leaders and. Then doesn't know what Aleppo is. I'm not sure he'd be the guy to turn to. But you think there's a chance for building right left to political coalitions?
I think on this issue, yes. I think there is a chance.
Well, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it, Victor Picard.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Victor Picard, who's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also been a senior research fellow at Free Press and the New America Foundation. And with Robert McChesney, he co-edited Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights. His latest book is America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. And he has an article at Origins, Media and Politics in the Age of Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the eviction of over 7,000 mostly African and Asian migrants stuck in a makeshift camp called the Jungle on the French coast at Calais. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Justin Salhani, who is a writer and journalist based in Washington, D.C. and Beirut, as well as a producer on documentaries and video reports. Currently a world reporter for Think Progress, focusing on human rights, he has an article at Think Progress, Calais Refugee Camp to be Dismantled. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Salhani.
Thanks for having me.
And it's a pretty horrific sight to see this, not that this temporary camp of between 7,000 and 10,000 migrants in Calais, France, near the English Channel, full of refugees hoping to go to the UK. It's been a kind of, it's called the Jungle, for the reasons that it is decrepit, overcrowded. It has no electricity, water, sanitary, hospitals, anything. It's a pretty horrific situation to begin with. But to look at the pictures of the people being forcibly evicted, the pain on their faces is extraordinary. So, and they're being sent to so-called welcome centers. And then what is their fate after they get sent to these welcome centers?
Well, after they go to the welcome centers, which, as you mentioned, they're distributed around France in about 450 different locations, from there they'll be processed. And when they're processed, their status will be determined whether they can apply for asylum or whether they will force deportation. So as you can imagine, their expectations of what to come, there's probably a lot of insecurity, a lot of stress. They have said that there's a number of the refugees who may decide to kind of stay in the area, may kind of make their way back and set up tents or camps, kind of dispersed throughout the Calais area. But, I mean, it is a moment of insecurity, and there is a number of people who feel as though their dreams or their hopes, you know, they thought at one point they might actually be able to make it to the UK, and those hopes are really shattered.
And most of these refugees come from Africa, I believe, from Eritrea, Somalia, and some from Afghanistan. This is a separate group of refugees, and also I think from some Asian countries as well. But this is a separate group from the Syrian refugees that came into Europe last summer.
Well, it's my understanding that the camp is kind of broken down into different tribes, sometimes along linguistic or geographical delineation. So I do believe there are some Syrians there, but I think you're right in that the majority do come from African countries, like you said, Eritrea, Ethiopia. There are a number of Afghans, and then just a number of other countries that are either going through wars or have really difficult, you know, a country like Eritrea has a very difficult situation for many citizens if you are on the wrong side of the government. So the only thing I think that you can say that they all share is that they're all looking for a better life and a place where they can resettle and have a decent standard of living.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Salahani, who is a writer and journalist based in Washington, D.C. and Beirut. And he has an article at Think Progress, Calais Refugee Camp to be Dismantled. And of course, it's pretty much being dismantled as we speak. And the people are from the camp are being bussed off to these so-called welcome centers. From there, we're not entirely sure of their fate. They don't, by and large, speak French, do they? They mostly speak English. Their destination has been the U.K. Does France want to take any of them on?
It seems like France is willing to settle some of these people. I mean, there's a number, I can't give you an exact figure, that have been granted some sort of resettlement in France. However, they didn't fit, for one reason or the other, they didn't feel comfortable in the culture, and so they've sought to go to a place where they do have a better connection, either through, like you mentioned, language or culture, or simply by having a relative there. As you know, the UK is probably in some ways and in some communities more diverse or at least more multicultural than France is, especially with recent laws that have been passed or threatened to be passed and pushed for. So I think yeah, there are some that have been welcomed in France. There are obviously some that came through by votes in places like Greece or in Italy and that have made their way up there with the hope of getting to the UK because of hopes or promises or maybe just a word from a friend that mentioned that the situation is much better in the UK. But I think France is willing to settle some of these people because, as I mentioned, there are a number of the people that are going to be sent to these centers to be reprocessed will be offered the chance to claim asylum.
Well, the desperation that you see in the faces, and that's always been there in this camp, and apparently the local police are pretty hostile, and there have been a number of clashes with the migrants and the local police. And I've seen video of the migrants rushing these convoys of trucks. They just overwhelm them and jump aboard because that's the how they get into the UK. And much of that activity is actually quite dangerous. So it makes sense to sort of to try to do something about this. But I take it a lot of people are not happy about what's happening. And the UNHCR is supporting the French government's move, are they not?
Right. So, I mean, there has been tension. I mean, tension has been building because of these camps, and this is a longstanding issue. I think the first camp was
built or settled there around 1999, and it was dissolved a couple of years later. But migrants have stuck around, and there were a smaller number until more recently with, you know, the larger migration in the last year or so. And so the numbers, I think, rose to an exponential level then. And then, you know, again, with recent terrorist attacks in Brussels and Paris, even though they aren't related to these migrants or refugees that are fleeing war, you know, these were mostly European citizens, there's still kind of a palpable fear from the local population. There's also a number of locals in Calais that you can read about that may say things like, look, you know, we're not racist. We don't, you know, maybe they want the best for these people, but they feel that there is a problem with the region not being able to kind of manage this growing refugee camp. And furthermore, like you mentioned, there's this issue with the local police. They've at times clashed. You know, there's been protests for various reasons, and sometimes the refugees there have disrupted the business proceedings with trucks trying to go by. And like you said, because they are so desperate, I mean, if they were in better situations, this wouldn't be happening. I think that's important to know and to note. But it has disrupted life in the region to some extent, and so I think that's why they're looking for a better chance. I think, you know, a great outcome would be if a number of these people could resettle in maybe smaller communities or communities where they can connect with locals and maybe find a better life. And if UNHCR is supporting this, I think that's great as well. But I think we can say to this point, maybe the French government hasn't been at its best in trying to find an easy and peaceful solution. You know, they've gone in before and talked about raising the camps. They've picked fights with with refugees. So, I mean, it absolutely is a two-sided issue, but I think that hopefully some good can come out of it. But at this point, I think there are still a lot of concerns, and human rights groups should keep their eyes on the ground just to make sure that everything is being done in a humanely a way as possible.
Well, when you say the French government have not necessarily treated these people properly, the British government, on the other hand, they built a wall, like a Donald Trump type of wall in France, to keep the migrants from getting into these tunnels and onto these trucks, etc., on their way to the UK. And that's cost the British $2.4 million. So given that the destination for these people that are in limbo is the UK, surely there is a certain amount of responsibility on the part of the British, are there not? I mean, the French are stuck with people that want to go to Britain, so it's difficult for me to figure out who's got the moral responsibility here.
Right, and I think it is a shared responsibility. I mean, Britain has accepted in some of the refugees, including a number of children, and there have been arguments in British Parliament to accept all the children in the camp. I believe Jeremy Corbyn visited the camp some months ago. And there's been disputes, but of course, I mean, England is, the UK, and particularly maybe England, is experiencing this kind of post-Brexit anti-immigration backlash at the same time. So in terms of morally and ethically responsibility, or the moral and ethical responsibility, I think it's a shared responsibility, not just between France and the UK, but between every country that is letting down the refugee and the migrant and the kind of global community here. But in this particular issue, I think, yes, you know, building a wall to stop people from coming in, you know, I think we've seen before throughout history that walls don't always keep people out. Just, you know, sometimes it'll just make people more resolute or resort to more maybe dangerous or self-harming or harming to others, you know, ways that might harm others in terms of trying to get to their destination. So, I think the UK needs to ask itself what more it can do. And unfortunately, you know, we're seeing this big rise in anti-immigration rhetoric and action from the UK at the moment. So I'm not sure if that will really come to fruition.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Justin Sadhani, is there any way to deal with these problems at their source? I mean, obviously, the hideous civil war in Syria is creating this refugee crisis, and it's going to get worse. And as Aleppo falls, which it probably will, to the Russians, the Iranians, and Assad, there'll be a massive exodus of Sunni, much, much bigger than the exodus that took place in Europe, where Germany had to take in 1 million people. That's, you know, I don't know what you can do about ending that civil war. People have tried, not necessarily sufficiently well, but they've tried. What can you do about the disgusting political situation in Eritrea and the failed state in Somalia and the horrible government in Ethiopia that's forcing these people out, along with the Sudan as well, where there's a civil war between the north and south and within South Sudan itself? So those are the sources of the problem, surely.
Right, and you do need to break off the problem at its source. Now, I mean, in regards to Syria, I don't think there's any easy answers. There are experts with better knowledge than I do that have proposed certain things, including a certain intervention that would be potentially different than what happened in Iraq, because there are a number of Syrian people, particularly in areas like Aleppo, that are asking for it. Hillary Clinton and actually Mike Pence, who is Donald Trump's running mate, have both proposed a no-fly zone. Of course, Donald Trump contradicted Mike Pence shortly afterwards, after making that statement in the last debate. But that being said, you know, a no-fly zone is one option. Of course, it comes with a lot of baggage, and there's a lot of questions surrounding it. I don't think there are any easy answers, but you know, a no-fly zone is one of those solutions that has been proposed that would hopefully stop civilian casualties at such a high level that are coming from Russian and Syrian airstrikes in areas like Aleppo. And additionally, it would hopefully give enough time for aid to be distributed and allow those areas to be a refuge for people who would normally flee the country if they have to. I mean, if you're still in Syria in certain areas, it often means that you're either too, you know, in these besieged areas, you're often either too poor, you're just kind of stuck from getting out. And so I think if these routes open up, you know, some of these people may have to flee. So I think, you know, a no-fly zone would be one option that should be given real consideration. In other areas like Eritrea, like Ethiopia, you know, government crackdowns, very strict government regimes that don't allow any sort of kind of democratic process or freedom of expression tend to be a big reason behind driving people out, and people are scared that something will happen to them or their families, so they leave. I don't know if there is really any easy fix there. It's, you know, these are generational issues that take a generation to change. Sure. With things like education and, you know, working with local civil societies to build stronger civil societies and working with the government to allow more expression and to realize that it's in their own interest as well. So I don't think there's any sure sign that this migration will stop. I've read that it could get worse as climate change gets worse in certain parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So there's really no easy solution, but I think, you know, strong countries need to work with other nations to try to find solutions domestically so that we can cut off these problems at the source.
Well, Justin Salhani, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Justin Salhani, who's a writer and journalist based in Washington, D.C. and Beirut, as well as a producer on documentaries and video reports. Currently, he's a world reporter for Think Progress, focusing on human rights, and he has an article at Think Progress, Calais Refugee Camp to Be Dismantled. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.